Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. For more information, visit FairwayMarket.com.
Hello, it's Chef's Story. My name is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. I'm from the International Culinary Center. But today we're here with Chef's Story at Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we're here every Wednesday at noon. And what do we do at Chef's Story? We interview chefs. And today we have a blockbuster chef with us, Emily Lucchetti. For those of you who maybe are East Coast locked, you might not know that she's the executive pastry chef at both Farallon and Water Bar in San Francisco, two extremely hot and wonderful restaurants. But it's going to take me a minute or two because I have to tell you everything this woman has accomplished. First of all, the biggie. She was chosen in 2004 as the James Beard Foundation's Pastry Chef of the Year. She beat out everybody. She's in the who's who of food and beverage in America. The San Francisco Chronicle named her one of the 20 visionary chefs in the Bay Area. She received the American Culinary Pioneer Award. She's in Food Arts Silver Spoon Awards. And she got from the Women Chefs and Restaurateur, a great national women's chef association, the Golden Whisk Award. And I can go on and on. We're not going to do that. She has five books. The latest one is Fearless Baker. When we walked into Roberta's here, the pastry chef, Melissa, said, "Oh, my God, I have your books. I love you." And that's the way a lot of pastry chefs feel. And so I'm just absolutely thrilled. Emily, we're old friends, and you are just inspirational. And welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. This is like a little Mecca oasis in Brooklyn. I'm ashamed I haven't been here before, but I haven't even left, and I can't wait to come back.
You know, it gives me a feel sort of like San Francisco in the Mission area, where people have, you know, outdoor spaces and things like
that. It does. I think I'm going to open a little pastry shop with a radio thing in the back.
Okay. We'd love it. So, you know what I'd like to ask people, like, who are you? Where did you come from? What were you like as a kid? Were you making, you know, wedding cakes at five? Where did you grow up? And tell me about your pastry life. When did you start baking?
You know, well, I actually grew up on the East Coast of the United States in Corning, New York, near Cornell and Ithaca.
Oh.
And so, you know, I'm an East Coast girl. And I think the first time I came to New York, I was 13. And I just felt my whole life had changed. But, you know, in New York, I had a typical suburban, you know, upbringing. It was a small town. It really wasn't the suburbs, but I made box brownies. I made box, you know, Duncan Hine cake mix. My mom made, you know, Toll House cookies fresh, and my parents always liked to cook, but the pastry end was kind of just something that was not, you know, I was a really picky eater. I like fish sticks and stuff like that. So it was, I really wasn't, even though I was surrounded by it, my early memories weren't of, you know, dining on bittersweet chocolate or anything like that. But it was one of those things that the older I got and just being around it, I really appreciated, you know, fine food. And even like for holidays and desserts, my parents would always make something different. Like we would always have a chocolate dessert on Thanksgiving. And it never even dawned on me that people had pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving.
Really? You never had pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving?
My mother and father didn't like pumpkin pie, so we never had it.
Did you have apple pie?
No, we just usually had chocolate dessert. So they were kind of like renegade doing what they wanted to do. And it wasn't until I got married and I'm with my husband's family, I go, "What's this pumpkin pie thing every year?" You know?
My gosh, what did you eat at Christmas?
Just various things. It was never, you know, a standard thing.
I hope you had a wedding cake.
I didn't even have a wedding cake when I got married.
You renegade.
I didn't even have a wedding cake.
You did?
No, because actually the place we got married, this jumping ahead a few years, but the place we got married was a club. It was the World Trade Club in San Francisco, in the building that the Ferry Building is in now, in downtown San Francisco. And it was an international kind of business club. And they weren't supposed to have weddings there because they would just be overrun with weddings. And my father-in-law was a member. So we just had like a dinner dance thing on a Friday afternoon. So we just had a dessert buffet. So
it's like the shoemaker without the shoes, really.
Well, but, you know, it was funny growing up, though, because my... you know, when I look back on it, my grandmother, one of them loved to cook, but she cooked more, you know, savory things. And my grandfather would clip little newspaper articles out of, you know, food and recipes and thing. And she actually won in 1964 the National Sunbeam Cooking Contest. And it was a recipe for blushing chicken, and it was chicken with cream and cranberry sauce. And they gave her a crown and a cape and all these Sunbeam appliances. So I got my picture in the paper when I was about seven, because I was at her house, and the Sunbeam person came over with, you know, the electric griddle, the electric frying pan, and all these different things.
How cool. So do you still make that recipe?
Actually, I haven't made it in a long time. I gave it to my brother the other day, because you look, it's just cream and cranberry and chicken. That's basically...
Sounds like easy.
It's really easy. That would be a good Thanksgiving thing.
Actually, you have a blog, don't you?
I do. I should actually put it up.
Can you post it?
Yeah.
I'm sure the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people out there. Did I mention this is heritageradionetwork.org? They can go to the website and find it. But so getting back to your childhood, so you were on the East Coast, you were making box
box stuff. My other grandmother really wasn't into cooking. She made great martinis, but I wasn't drinking them at that age.
She had a cool family.
And then when my dad was 50, he retired. He had owned a family newspaper in Corning, New York, and my mom and he moved to Sanibel Island, Florida, and opened up. He started a weekly newspaper down there with some other guys, but they wanted to do something together, and so they opened up a cookware shop. It was called the Unpressured Cooker, and this was about 1975, and it was before, you know, Macy's had their cellar in New York, but the Cuisinart had just come out. Carbon steel knives were big, and it was just the whole kind of cooking thing was just starting to kind of build and, you know, get unleashed in the United States. And so they ran that for about 15 years. And during college, I would work for them in the summer, and I would sell Calphalon pots, I would sell Cuisinarts, and I really kind of developed my love for food even at that point. Just, you know, working.
Did you come home after working and cook?
Well, we didn't go to college down there, so in the summers I would just go down, and that would be my summer job would be working there. And, you know, and I just kind of loved being around the whole food thing. And they got Giuliano Bugiali would come down and teach classes.
Really?
And yeah, so it was pretty cool. And but it wasn't like fast paced enough for me, so I said, I think I don't want just the pots and pans end of it, I want the food end of it. So I moved to New York City after I got out of college, and I was like most graduates with a degree in sociology, had no idea what I wanted to do. And I saw an ad in the New York Times that said, no typing required. And it was a company near Wall Street looking for a kind of sous chef / dishwasher to work in an executive dining room. And so I said to myself, well, I'll do this while I wait for, you know, something.
So you had no professional food experience?
No professional food experience at that time.
And you became the sous chef?
Well, it was the sous chef / bottle washer / dishwasher. And the other person in the kitchen was a woman, and she was going to law school. So she was kind of getting out of food. So, and we did small parties. It was like, you know, 10 or 15 people. It was for the top 10 executives in the company. So
it wasn't Goldman Sachs.
No, it was J. Aaron and Company that was bought out by Goldman Sachs later on.
All right.
And so it was like more like giving dinner parties because of the size and the volume. And so I worked there for about a year and a half, and I absolutely loved it. And I said, well, if you're going to be around food all the time, you should get an education, and you should try to do it all the time and get paid for it. So I went to the New York Restaurant School at the time. International Culinary Center, or FCI, wasn't open yet. I was like a year ahead of my time.
Thank you.
Because I was a career changer, you know. It would have been perfect. So I went to the New York Restaurant School, which is a 6-month program. I'd gotten into the CIA, but I didn't want to go back to 2 years of school. I really just wanted to kind of get some base knowledge and then get out there and work. This was all in culinary. It wasn't even in pastry. And then I went to France for a year and worked and just at stage.
What propelled you to France?
What propelled me to France was just the food and the food culture. Because I said, it's like, if you want to learn about food, you have to go to the source. You know, it's like the source of the Nile. It's the source you have to. And that's what, you know, when I came back, people said, did you get a lot of recipes? Did you learn? I said, you know, on the one hand, I was young. I was 23. I was so over my head. But on the other hand, what you walk away with, one, is a work ethic, and two, is a standard of quality. And you just living there for a year, just through your bones and your skin, you pick up the food culture. And it is just so important part of everyone's life. And even if people don't know how to make a terrine of foie gras, or they don't know how to make puff pastry, they know what good foie gras or good puff pastry tastes like. And that is, I think, one of the things that really was instilled in me, is just about the quality and the care of not just product, but technique and the craft of getting something from a bowl of lettuce or whatever into a dish.
How hard was it so you went to cooking school. You graduated from college. You went to cooking school, and you worked.
I worked at for Gérard Pango in
It was a 2-3 star New York Times chef.
Right. He was in Paris, and then he came to New York and owned Aurora Restaurant for many years. And now I think he moved to D.C. Mm-hmm. I think that I was actually one of the first women that had come in there and was staying for an extended period of time. Most people went in there and stayed for, a couple weeks and did a brief stage, but I stayed there for a year. And
how did you get the job, like visa wise?
Oh, actually, I was on a tourist visa, and I just after a few months, I would leave and then just come back. But the woman that I was working at the executive dining room knew him, and I wrote like 10 French chefs, and I should have saved the letter, but Bocuse sent me a letter saying, well, yes, that's fine, but we don't allow women in our kitchen. And it's a rejection, you just throw it out.
That in the next section of the show.
He took me on. I think at that point, even, he wanted to come to the United States, and so he really was trying to open up his ties, and he knew Lois, the woman that I work for, pretty well, and so he said, sure, send her.
Fabulous. So you lived in Paris?
I lived outside of Paris. He gave me, I didn't get paid, but he gave me a room that was like this tiny room off of, in this building that his father-in-law owned. And it was like so small. It was like it was one of those squat kind of porcelain toilets, in
no.
the bed. And so your shower was over the toilet. And it was just like, there'd be nights it'd be like, they were closed like on Saturday and Sunday, which was pretty, rare for restaurants then. But I just remember just going back to my room with my coffee mug and my wine, my 5-franc bottle of wine, thinking, what have I gotten myself into?
It sounds so romantic.
Yeah, it's romantic when you look back on it.
Really.
And the other side is what doesn't kill you. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So
when you came back to the States with all of this experience under your belt, extraordinary experience under your belt, did you find that the doors of the kitchens in America opened to you because of it?
And
were you doing pastry or
no? This
savory?
Is all savory. This is all
okay.
Savory.
So you're regular.
Yeah, this is all savory. And I came back and I decided with my boyfriend at the time, who's now been my husband for 25 years, that we wanted to move to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of got a stopgap job in the meantime at the Silver Palette with Sheila Lukens and Julie Rosso. And I worked there for a year, and that was actually fun because it was the beginning of, they were the first gourmet takeout shop in Manhattan, and people. It's hard for them to think about the fact that those places just didn't exist. Mm-hmm. They didn't exist at all. And then when I moved out to San Francisco, it was about 3 months before Stars Restaurant was opening up with Jeremiah Tower. Mm-hmm. And the France thing definitely got my foot in that door,
with
and it
Jeremiah.
Didn't matter that when I got the job, I was, opening oysters and making pizzas and things like that.
So you became the chef, the pastry chef there, but you started as
I started as a savory chef. I didn't realize
that.
There and worked on the line and became lunch chef. And then it was.
And that was your first American job after Paris?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Except for Silver Palette. Yeah.
Except
and I'd actually worked in a couple of New York restaurants after school, before I went to Paris very briefly, about a year. One was at Manhattan Market with David Lederman. That was my first job after cooking school, so hopefully they don't remember me, because when you're first out of school like that, you know nothing. And then I worked at a tiny, tiny place on 26th and 3rd called Caliban. And and that's actually where I was working, and this is a great story, and I told Andre Saltner this story a couple weeks ago. I was working there one night, and Peter called up my boyfriend, and he said, hey, I just got invited the last minute to go to Lutes for dinner. Can you come? And I said, it's 5 o'clock in the evening. I have to work the line tonight. I can't come to Lutes for dinner. And my boss heard me and he said, what's that? And I explained it to him. He said, you're going to Lutes tonight. He said, you will learn more at Lutes eating than you will, you know, cooking here on the line tonight. He said, I'll cover your station. Go. And within an hour, I was sitting at Lutes for dinner. And
oh,
this
my.
This was probably 1982.
What a great chef.
Oh, I know.
Well,
I know.
we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back and hear a lot more about your
profession. We haven't even gotten to the pastry part.
No.
This program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries, they cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Well, welcome back. This is HeritageRadioNetwork.com, and you're listening to Chef Story with moi, Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and my very special guest, pastry chef extraordinaire, Emily Lucchetti. So, Emily, we were just talking about an enlightened chef sending you to Lutes rather than working. And I have to say, I'm just thrilled because you've just joined the International Culinary Center as dean, and the fellow dean, Andre Soltner, you know, the master chef owner of Lutes, was where you went. You know, we spoke in the last 15 minutes about you getting a rejection letter from Paul Bocuse saying you couldn't work in his kitchen because you're a woman. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what it was like back in those days, even in America, for a woman's chance in a kitchen?
Yeah.
And how has that evolved over the years? What's it like today?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think I was very fortunate to spend the bulk of my years of my career in San Francisco, because I think in San Francisco, there isn't the it's kind of much more free-for-all, and if you're good, you can succeed, and they're just, it's a little bit more casual, it's a lot more casual. And you know, in working actually for Jeremiah as a woman, I never felt like I wasn't getting my due either in San Francisco or working for Jeremiah. I mean, for him, it was always like, if you're good, you're good. It doesn't matter, you know, what sex you are or anything. So I was really fortunate. And I think a lot of people in San Francisco feel the same way. And also, I know a lot of guys who actually prefer working for a woman. And I think that there's, you know, so many different ways that people's realities are, but I think in San Francisco it really isn't that much, you know, of an issue, and I've been really, you know, fortunate about that. And but at the same time, I think, you know, and the advice I've always given people, because you and I were on the board of Women Chefs and Restaurateurs together, that I talk to my friends through that, the women that are my age and that have worked through it in other cities, they had real problems and they weren't allowed to do a lot of different things. I said, and I think the one thing that was really fortunate about the whole explosion of American cooking was that it brought people, you know, the traditional, you know, way in the United States was much more of a European method, and it was more of a male hierarchy. And when the whole women thing came, when the whole American thing came, I think it kind of opened it up, and everybody started,
Are there a lot more American women in the kitchen than you think in Europe?
Yes, I do. I do.
And even today?
I think even today. And I also think that, you know, it's interesting, when we were part of Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, in San Francisco, it's a really small community, and everybody knows everybody, so everybody helps everyone, and that may be more of a female thing, but it's male and female alike. But I remember coming to New York and knowing two or three pastry chefs or chefs in general that lived and worked within four blocks of each other in Manhattan, and they didn't even know each other. And I came from San Francisco and hooked them up and linked them together. So I think it's that there just isn't that that kind of camaraderie. It's all, everyone's kind of going to work. They're focused on, you know, their little niche, and they're not really kind of broadening out and being kind of supportive and, you know, and making it more of a community, really. So I don't want to belittle it and say that I don't think it existed, because I think it did. But the good news in San Francisco is, yeah, there were yellers and screamers in the kitchen, and yes, there were those people that, you know, wouldn't promote you because you were a woman. But fortunately, there were other places to go. You know, I would say to people, listen, if you're learning something somewhere, stick with it. If, you know, if the good outweighs the bad, stick with it. The minute you walk in the door and the bad outweighs the good, go find another job.
Well, I thought we really arrived when, I forget when Women Chefs and Restaurateurs started, maybe in the late 90s, early 2000. But anyway, about 4 years ago, I went to one of the organization's meetings, and there were women there at the meeting saying, raising their hands and saying, you know, I have all these guys that want to join. Why are we excluding them?
Guys.
And I said, wait a minute, this is all about empowering women to get ahead in the kitchen. And they said, you mean we couldn't get ahead? And I thought, that has really arrived.
Yeah,
so I don't think that prejudice is there, maybe on an occasional basis. But the one thing I do notice at, you know, our school is that in the pastry department, 80% are women studying to be pastry chefs. Why is there an inordinate amount of female pastry chefs as opposed to savory?
Yeah, I think, you know, and there are, and I see the resumes that come across my desk. I mean, there are days where I just say, I want to get a good male resume because I want to hire a guy, because I'd rather have a team of, you know, both men and women. And but sometimes the male resumes aren't just there. I think it really, you know, I think it has to do with the skills that are required and the personality of the two jobs. You know, the fact that I've worked both culinary and pastry, one of the reasons I switched was I was losing my love for culinary. I didn't like working the line. I hated working the line.
Why?
I didn't like the intensity of it. I didn't like the pressure of it. What the most thing I didn't like was, I didn't like knowing in an evening if I was going to have a really busy, terrible night or a really slow night, because the guy at the other end is calling you down and saying, cook four chicken, four scallops, kind of as the orders go down. But you're cooking more a la minute and it's last minute, so you don't kind of have that control. Mm. And in pastry, you know, obviously you're plating desserts at night, but the bulk of your work is spaced out during the day. And so you go in and you're making all your chocolate cakes and all your, you know, what tarts or whatever. And there's a lot to do, but there's a even pace to it. And sometimes I think that that's maybe more of a female thing than than a male thing. This just has to do with the organization of the work and how people want to spend their time.
You know, we give a test called the predictive index, which kind of is a personality test. And we can say to people, you know, we think you'd be better on the line or better in the pastry kitchen. And we find that people who skew to the pastry kitchen are architects, medical people, incredibly precise people who want control.
Yeah, and surgeons. I mean, you know, I talk to so many home bakers that are surgeons. The other thing, too, when I talk to home bakers, they'll say, well, or people that, you know, do some baking at home and some cooking, they'll say, well, I like to cook, but I don't like to bake. And I say, well, do you like to follow instructions? They said, no, I don't follow instructions. I said, well, that's why you don't want to bake.
Exactly. Once you put that, it's not a little of this and a little of that.
Yeah.
No. So you and I met, I think, through Women Chefs and Restaurateurs on the board, and you have always taken a leadership position. And recently, in the last few days, it's been announced that you are the new chairman of the James Beard Foundation.
That's
so
right.
Congratulations.
Thank
you for taking that on. That's a huge organization, and you are a major leader. If you had one thing to leave a legacy in the Beard Foundation, is there one thing that you think this industry needs and the foundation can help?
Yeah, I think the foundation is a really great foundation. It really brings the community of chefs and cooks and food authors and wine people all together. I would like to turn it more into an organization, though, that doesn't just give awards out. And I know Susan Ungaro, who's the president, you know, the awards are fine, and it's fun that somebody gets Pastry Chef of the Year. It's a real honor, and et cetera, et cetera. But I'd like to make it an organization where people don't just think of it for that one thing every year, and make it something that, you know, chefs and members are really excited to be a part of, because it really influences their life and the way they do their jobs and the people that they work with, and make it a much more... make it a much more relevant thing. And I think, you know, yes, it's great. It's a fine dining type of organization, but let's go beyond that. Let's go beyond that.
Well, you're such a mentor to so many people I know. And can you share with us, one of the things we were talking about is how pastry has evolved in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Is it the same as when you were starting out, or where is the profession today, and what do you have to know?
Yeah, well, you know, when I first started out in pastry, I just decided that I wanted to go into the pastry department. I eyed it on the other side of the kitchen at Stars, and the woman that was the pastry chef ahead of me was pregnant, and she was leaving, so I had 9 months to convince Jeremiah Tower that he needed to give me the job, and God bless him, he said, sure, give it a try. And, you know, back then, people really... food reviewers, customers, everyone, they really weren't paying attention to desserts that much. It was more kind of they were paying attention to the fish and the produce, because people were getting excited about that because it was all really new. And so you could really put a pastry chef that didn't have any pastry experience as the pastry chef of a really well-known restaurant at Stars was at that time in 1987. It opened in 1984. And where, because it was all kind of under the radar, and all the learning that I did was very kind of trial and error. And, you know, I'd get up really early in the morning so I could remake everything if I had to. So by the time 5:30 rolled around and we opened for dinner, I had something, you know, to show for it. But nowadays, you could never take a high restaurant of that caliber and just put somebody on there that didn't have pastry experience. I mean, it wouldn't be fair to the person, it wouldn't be fair to the restaurant. And so you really need the fundamental, you know, training. And that's what I think is really important about a culinary education, you know, wherever you go to school, if it's a community college, if it's the ICC or whatever, is that it really gives you the fundamental techniques that you need to then, you know, go into the workplace so you have at least an understanding, so then you can learn and take it from there, because it's always everyday learning.
So how have the desserts changed in 20 years?
The desserts, it's interesting, because in the very beginning when I started, it was always everything was very French oriented, and there were soufflés and there were tarts, and it was very classical French. And then the whole American thing, the whole American regional food kicked in. And people started doing like angel food cake and, you know, shortcakes and things like that. And the pendulum swung so far the other way of just doing crisps and pies and things like that. And, you know, people just loved it because it was full of flavor and it was there. And then after that kind of wore off for a while, a lot of the pastry chefs in the United States got into a very architectural kind of contrived stage where everything was very, very ornate. And what was interesting too is that, you know, everybody kind of, all the pastry chefs went to from one thing to the other. A lot of them, they were architectural. Before that, they were just really American down home. But now what's happened in the last 10 years is there's so many different styles out there. And what's great about it is everyone's doing their own style. Like, I have my style that is more American.
Well, how do you describe your style?
I always call my style kind of simple but elegant. It's all flavor driven. You get the real wow when you take a bite of it, but at the same time, you want it to be visually appealing. But it's kind of like I always look at it as it's kind of like the classic suit a woman has on or a man has on. And you look at it and you go, oh, that's beautiful. It's got nice lines to it. And then you kind of look at it closer and you take a bite and it's like, okay, I get it now. You know, I get it now.
So everybody's listening to this. Which of your cookbooks do you think, if they're going to start out with your desserts, which one should they start with?
Well, I think it depends. If you're a home baker, I would say The Fearless Baker, because it was written for cooks who don't bake and are have fear of it. We were first going to call it the terrified baker, but we didn't think that was as empowering as fearless baker. But I think it also, if you're in the business, I think I would actually go back to Stars Desserts, because when I wrote that book, I was actually amazed when it came out how many savory chefs came to me and said, you know, I'm in charge of the desserts at the restaurant, and I use your recipes as kind of building blocks to create things on my own. Like, I'll give it my own twist. I'll make your gingerbread because it's a great gingerbread recipe, but then I'll add, you know, this cream to it or that fruit to it, and I'll turn it into something totally of my own. And to me, that was really fun, because I think that's, even though pastry does work so much on recipes, when people come to me and say, well, I took it and they changed it, I hope you don't mind, I said, I'm thrilled you changed it, because there's so many different things that you can do, and it just gives it a whole new life and a whole new creative, you know, input and outlook on it, that it takes it in a completely different direction.
I know our chefs are always going to the students, taste, taste, taste. You have to taste as you go along. If you're a pastry chef tasting all day, what does that do to your mouth? The sugar. I mean, can you taste, taste, taste all day as a pastry chef?
Well, one, the sugar does kind of, you do have to wash your palate out with a good steak or something like that in between. But I think there are two levels of, when you're testing a dessert and you're creating a dessert, there's a lot of tasting that goes on. But the good thing about, like, if you are developing a cake recipe, and once you get it going and you put it on the menu, you don't have to taste it every day, because you know if it came out of the oven, it looks okay, you did it right. But the things that you always have to taste are the balance of all the things on the plate. And fruit is a perfect example. You know, strawberries aren't the same. Mm-hmm. Even apples, which you are available all year round, you know, you get a strawberry in the middle of the summer, and you eat it, and you don't need any sugar on it at all. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do anything to it. Mm-hmm. Where if you get one earlier in the year and the sun hasn't, you know, been able to kiss it so much, then you need to add a little bit of sugar to it. And, you know, and it is about tasting. I think a lot of pastry chefs don't taste their food enough. They're going more by the recipe. And, mm-hmm. you know, whenever I would take a dessert to Mark in my early years, Mark Franz, who's the chef I've worked with for 25 years, I'd say, well, you taste this and give me your opinion. And he'd always say salt and acid. And so people use lemon juice and salt in savory cooking, but it's got such a fundamental role in baking too, especially if you put that little bit on strawberries or apples when you're sauteing them in a pan. It really helps draw out the flavor.
Yeah. Ooh, it sounds so good. Okay, well, we're going to have to take a little break here, and we'll come back and talk some more. Welcome back. We're on heritageradionetwork.org, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton with Chef Story. And today we have East Coast, West Coast, super pastry chef Emily Lucchetti with us. And Emily, we've been talking about a lot of things, from influences, how pastry chefs taste, and we were talking about sugar in the mouth. And I kind of want to ask you about sugar itself. It's gotten such a bad rap. And, you know, you go to France and you don't see these big obese people, and you see the most extraordinary pastry shops, and they're eating them, and they're eating the baguettes and the bread. And now, you know, we're seeing policies where people want to take the sugar out of everything. Do you have an opinion on this? What's going on?
Well, you know, I think we do have a real weight problem in the United States. There is a real obesity problem. But I kind of look at it from a more moderation point of view. And I also look at it as it's not going to, the sugar isn't going to disappear. So, yes, you know, and I think the thing, too, with pastry chefs is that if you look at pastry chefs, first of all, across the country as a general group, the majority of them are pretty healthy. And actually, I think if you compared them, I haven't done a scientific study on this, but my gut is, after traveling all over the world, as long as I have, doing food, is that actually pastry chefs are in better shape and take better care of themselves than savory chefs do.
Really?
And I think some of that is when you're in a pastry department and you're working all day, you know that you can't just eat the sugar and, you know, whatever's around all day. You need some nutrition, or else you're going to crash and burn at 3 o'clock and you have to work, you know, into the evening. So I think, you know, we've kind of learned that you can't live all by sugar, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I often have asked, well, how can you be so healthy when you're around desserts all the time? It's like, well, first of all, you don't have a devil's food cake for dinner every single night. You know, I only have dessert if we have company over, or if I'm testing something, or, you know, we're going out to a restaurant. It's not something, you know, that's we have all the time. You know, and that being said, it is about, you know, healthy eating. And, you know, I'm all for every program that says we have to eat more fresh vegetables, we have to eat more lean meats, we have to eat more whole grains. I believe in that 100% because that's the way I live my life. But at the same time, I think we're a little bit naive to think that people are just going to not eat sugar anymore. And I also think from an emotional standpoint, I don't want to get to that point. I don't want to get to point one, because no one will want my services as a pastry chef, then I'd be out of a job. But also, I think that there's an emotional reward and a celebration thing that comes, you know, from eating a nice piece of cake for a birthday or whatever. So I really think that it's all, we need to get the sugar out of the processed food. We need to have, you know, people stop drinking so much soda because of the amount of sugar and the calories that are in that. But if you eat a healthy diet of, you know, the whole grains, the vegetables, and you save the desserts for the, you know, the special occasions and, you know, the cookie, the piece of cake, and you don't have it something that's twice a day or even once a day, I think that there's a real place for it, you know. And I feel, you know, when they say, oh, we're going to take the bake sales, you know, no more bake sales because it's adding to the obesity problem. Well, that's kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. One, you know, it's, to me, whenever I drive by a bake sale, I buy everything because I want to support the young kids that are doing right. doing the bake sale. But I think it's all about understanding what you can put in and out of your body. I mean, it's kind of like finances for me is, you know, if you only have $50 in the bank, you don't go and buy the $100 sweater. You know, right. You just don't do it. And I know a lot of people do, and that's why everybody has credit card debt. Well, they have to really kind of look at it the same. You have to look at the number of calories you have, how you want to, you know, space them out, what you want to do, and have a healthy life. And you can honestly do both. And I think that comes from a discipline. And I think that a lot of Americans don't like to instill too much discipline. When they want that cake, they want it now. Mm-hmm. And it's also, they have to be a little bit thinking more of the future and not just of today. And I think that's another thing sometimes that, you know, they're thinking, oh, I want the cake today, and, you know, I'm going to have cake again tomorrow. Well, if you have cake today, don't have it tomorrow.
Right.
You know, it's on the one hand, I think it's so simple that people are trying to make the answers too complicated, when it's all about self. It's about responsibility. It's about self-responsibility. And, you know, it's like the amount of money that's being channeled into creating some kind of pill that you can take so you can eat all the cake that you want. Well, take that money and use it for so many other important, you know, health concerns, getting vegetables in grocery stores and where people don't have them, that kind of thing. And just rechannel that money and just get people to be more responsible.
Well, you know, you're known as a pastry chef for having huge flavor in your desserts. And so one of my questions has been, a lot of people look at quantity, like they don't feel full. And I think some of these diets or whatever, they fill you with these calories that don't make you feel full. And so in your brain, you need to have fat in your mouth. You
right.
need to have
right.
a little sugar. And if you don't have it, you'll never be satisfied. So are there some flavor bombs that you know, high quality. Some people say just take a little high quality piece of chocolate.
Yeah. The perfect example of that is, and this would happen to me too, is if you take like a commercial candy bar and you eat it, you have to eat like the whole thing or two of them to be satiated and really feel like you got your sugar fix.
Why?
Because it's all sugar and it's most of it's sugar and not enough of it is either chocolate or flavor driven. And I think what happens when people make desserts too sweet is it masks their flavor, it hides it. And so it kind of makes it a more neutral platform where it doesn't have any real highs, and so you don't get that chocolate intensity. Even like you make a cake with pecans, if it's got too much sugar in it, it doesn't taste pecan-y enough. You know, you want that first bite to be full of pecan and full of flavor. And, you know, and people will say, well, your desserts are, you know, people say to me, I don't like desserts, but your desserts aren't too sweet and they're good. I go, you've been eating, there's too much sugar in a lot of the desserts. And it's not just from a sugar consumption standpoint, but it's also a flavor, standpoint.
How does fat play in that? You know, how does sugar play in your mouth and how does fat play
in
your mouth?
Well, sugar is like a vehicle for fat, really, when you think about the creaming of the sugar and things like that. Not only is a vehicle, it adds texture, and it also it does add flavor. But you know, if you go back to that chocolate candy bar, where you have to have a whole 8 ounce candy bar to feel full, where if you take some bittersweet chocolate or a 60%, you'll have a couple bites and you'll feel full because it's got so much more intensity to it. And I think that's what people are, they're kind of really eating, the wrong thing. And also they're eating without thinking about it. It's like how you can sit down and eat like a bag of chips and, because you're watching TV or something, and then you look at the bag, you go, oh my God, that's empty, and I don't remember eating any of it. So I think it's being more focused on when you are eating something, focusing on its pleasure and really concentrating on it. So then you'll know that you ate it and you'll remember you ate it and you get the pleasure out of it.
How important is it to bake with your kids? You know, we're told everybody should cook with their kids. And I remember when my wonderful daughter Olivia was young, she loved those Duncan Hine boxes and opened them up. And I thought that was great because, you don't have to read. It actually has the graphics on the back. And at 5, she was making cakes.
Yeah.
And I think that spurred her into the kitchen. I mean, they're not going to do, sauteed.
Right.
At that age.
Yeah, and I think it's a great start. I don't poo-poo anything. I really don't. I think it's a great start. I think you want to really do anything that would get, kids in the kitchen. And I think the other thing, too, that when it comes to desserts in general, I think if kids especially actually spent some time making the desserts, then they would appreciate it more. I remember when I was a kid and I would make something and my brothers would just grab some and they would just like wolf it down. I go, wait a second. I spent a half an hour making that. You have to appreciate that more. It's not like you have to, thank me 10,000 times, but don't just wolf it down and go for that sugar intense rush and not appreciate what you're doing. So I think if kids were more a part of the process of baking and realized the art and craft of it, then I think you have a better appreciation for it and a better respect for it. Because, when you bake, there are two levels of satisfaction you get. One is you're creating something with your hands that you have. It's very concrete. It's on the table. It's like, I made this tart. I created it. And then the other level of satisfaction is giving it to other people and sharing that so their lives are, enriched and they're happy, campers after eating it. So I think that this, what happens with the cookies that are at the market or the fast food store, people buy them and they consume them, and within 5 minutes the experience is over, but it's not lasting. Like if I go to a restaurant and I have a really good dessert, the next day I'm still thinking about it. But when do you think about that cookie or something that you just bought at the mini mart and you just shoved in your face?
But
and
it, it has no aftertaste. It's like a great wine or great food. You put it in your mouth and you can't eat it quickly because it's so full of flavor. And once you swallow it, you get other flavors.
And then you have the memory of it.
That's right. And if you go and get some commercial thing that just has a sugar pop, you just want more. The sugar makes you addicted to it. So, let's get your take on all of these Food Network shows that, feature pastries. Do you think they're good? Does it distort what pastry chefs really do, or is it a really good insight to how hard it is?
I think actually it's been a really good thing overall, because I think it's really brought an awareness to different types of pastry and the skill sets that are involved. I think, people, there's been enough reality shows and people and shows on PBS, and there's so much information about food out there that the customer, the consumer, whoever watches TV is able to discern and differentiate between this is a reality kind of entertainment cooking show versus this is what it takes to actually hone your craft and do your job. So I think in that regard, I think it's been really good. The one thing I worry, though, about is I see when a lot of the kids come to me and they want jobs, or they all kind of want to work in the baking business now, and they want to work in decorating a cake or something like that, which I think is a great thing to be in. But I think when some of the younger kids come in, and they can be a little bit skewed because everybody wants the instant. So many people now, the younger kids, they want the instant fame of it. And if you're going to be in this profession, you want to be a baker or a pastry chef or even a chef, you have to love it every single day when you get up in the morning, and you want to go to work and do it every day. You don't just do it for the awards. You don't just do it for the television appearances. You do it because you want to get up in the morning, you want to cook, and you want to give that food to other people to make them happy.
That says it all. Before we close, I've got a couple of questions. What's the name of your blog?
Actually, it's the EmilyLucchetti.com has a blog. It's EmilyLucchettiBlog.com. But San Francisco Chronicle has a great version of the newspaper. It's a great version of their newspaper online. It's called Inside Scoop. sf.com, and they have kind of all the Bay Area happenings in food, and they have a group of chefs that once a week or so write about different things about food. So I'm included in that. It's on the Voices tab. So if you click on that, you'll see my blogs and also a lot of really interesting blogs from other chefs from the Bay Area.
Okay, and last question. Out of all the utensils you have in your kitchen, which one do you covet the most?
My mini offset spatula.
What is a mini offset spatula?
Well, it's kind of like a long, narrow metal spatula like you'd use to ice a cake. But offset means that it's flat and then it goes up a little bit. So when you're using it to frost a cake, your hand is away from the frosting and everything like that. So you get in there. You can get in there. And traditionally, they're like 9 inches. But they make one that's like 4 inches. And you can get them at any cookware shop. And they're 4 inches. And they're great for like frosting the side of a cake or spreading batter out in a 9-inch pan or spreading jam on toast. It's one of those things that's a really universal tool.
That was so immediate. I can't wait to run out and buy one. Okay, well, I have to thank you. Emily Lucchetti is just an extraordinary person and a very, very talented chef, and it's just been a pleasure speaking
thank
to you.
It's been great being here.
Well, thank you. It's heritageradionetwork.org, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton and Chef Story saying see you next week. Or not see you.
Hear you.
Hear you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.